Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske, the greatest jockey of all time. If you went back in time to the 1800s and picked Isaac Burns Murphy, you would definitely have a case. Isaac Burns Murphy was the first jockey to win the Kentucky Derby three times, and he boasted of a 44% winning percentage, which may never be equaled. Pelham McDaniels has written a new biography of Isaac Burns Murphy that chronicles the amazing life of the jockey. With all his winnings, Murphy helped give rise to the black middle class. Pelham McDaniels' book is The Prince of Jockeys, The Life of Isaac Burns Murphy. Pelham McDaniels spent six seasons with the Chiefs as a defensive end, then two more with the Atlanta Falcons. Today, he's an assistant professor of African American Studies at Emory University down in Atlanta. And Pelham, so good to have you back. Welcome back to Kansas City.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Well, in the pantheon of great jockeys, Pelham, where does Isaac Burns Murphy rank?
I think he's right on top. Not just because of his winning percentage, but how he won and how he changed horse racing from the perspective of having not just quality jockeys, but honest jockeys who could not just win races, but position the owners to have those horses ready for other races.
You know, I may have heard of him before. I'm guessing that in the world of horse racing, those folks know who this guy was.
Well, yeah, you know, some do, but I am amazed still that some don't. That
really?
Isaac Murphy's name is kind of like a whisper on the wind. You know, some may have heard of his name, or they may have only heard of his name because of a race in Chicago named after him, or even they may have driven through Lexington and seen a street or sign that says Isaac Murphy lived here or Isaac Murphy Way. But I don't think people who are involved in horse racing really understand not just Murphy, but the impact of African Americans on the sport.
His greatest feat on the horse track would have been what?
Winning every race at a meet in Detroit. Basically won the card.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Like 10, 12 races or something.
Well, at that time, there were probably only six races.
Yeah.
And so what happens, and we talked about this earlier, with racing in New York in the Northeast, the number of races in a day increased, almost doubled in one day to get as much betting in as you could. Early in the early part of the 1880s, late 1870s, you may have only had five races in one day because they were interested in the quality of the horse, not necessarily the betting or gambling that took place at the track.
So the whole thing evolved over time.
It evolved over time, and it changed dramatically.
You know, why a book on a jockey, Pelham, who died more than 100 years ago?
Well, you know, my research, as I finished up playing, I went directly to graduate school at Emory, and I had this question, you know, what has been the impact of black athletes on 20th century America? And it's a huge question because there are different angles you can take. Well, I decided that to understand the impact on the 20th century, I had to look back in the 19th century. And there had been studies on Moses Fleetwood Walker, studies on Peter Jackson, the great black heavyweight champion from Australia, who John L. Sutherland refused to fight. Hmm. And then there was a little bit written on black jockeys. And I say a little bit because Ed Hodling, yes, the journalist who wrote quite a bit about Saratoga and horse racing, has this book called The Great Black Jockeys.
Yeah.
And there are these vignettes about different jockeys from, you know, Abe Hawkins to Isaac Murphy and Jimmy Wakefield. But there had not been, and maybe overstating this, I think Joe Drake did a great job with Jimmy Wakefield, but thinking about the mid to the later part of the 19th century, there wasn't a biography on someone like Murphy. And I discovered Murphy just in trying to find out how important horse racing was. And his name popped up as this elegant specimen of manhood. And I thought, that's kind of odd, considering this is the, you know, post-Civil War, you know, post-bellum Reconstruction era, and to have this black man, a former slave, in a basically a white newspaper, be accounted for as an elegant specimen of manhood, it seemed odd.
And that's because during those years, at least in part, Pelham, racial relations in this country had eased a little bit. The tensions had eased coming out of the war. They would pick back up later. But for a little while there, things were a little better, right?
Especially in horse racing. So, again, thinking about the development of horse racing in America, those individuals who would have stables and would have the land to be able to develop horses and race horses would also have owned slaves. And so to have these enslaved people clearing the property of rocks and boulders and timber to be able to farm it to grow hemp, tobacco, mm-hmm. corn, and raise horses required labor. And what was the labor prior to the Civil War besides African Americans? They may have been some immigrants, but not as many as you needed to clear this bluegrass area of Kentucky.
So the notion that one of these ex-slaves would rise up and become as famous as Isaac Burns Murphy, that isn't all that far-fetched.
Not at all. And mm-hmm. I think that's where the confusion for most, you know, for when I have these conversations, it lies, is that they don't realize the people connected to horse racing were also slave owners. Mm-hmm. And so therefore their labor would be these black men and boys. When I say boys, you had as young as maybe 6 years old getting on the backs of these horses, because really the lightweight jockeys allowed for the horse to run, right? So you didn't have any impediment on the back of that horse, so you didn't get a true sense of the horse strengths.
Hey, had you heard of Isaac Burns Murphy before you began working on this book?
Not heard of him.
So you're like the rest of us.
Yes,
yeah.
I mm-hmm. had not heard of him. And then just doing this work and coming across, I mean, you'll find in James Weldon Johnson's Black Manhattan, the discussion about black jockeys and how they were in vogue and they would, you know, spend the money and have the champagne in these little night spots in New York. Because, again, Saratoga, Long Branch, Monmouth Park, all these tracks were there. And then you find other kind of vignettes and other novels and even accounts in journals. But rarely did I come upon just something as detailed as Hodling's book on black jockeys.
I was going to say, how tough was it to come up with information on this guy? You're going back more than 100 years, and I'm sure there weren't tons of records.
Yeah, you're correct. Murphy, as important as he was to horse racing, and you know, when you read newspaper accounts, when newspaper men were interviewing him, I found it fascinating the language used. And it seemed to me that here was someone who had a sense of himself. He had a sense of where he was in this the world, and how he carried himself, how he addressed the public. He was very aware of what he was doing. He was very aware of people watching him. And so he had no papers. Currently, I can't find this cachet of letters between he and his wife or documents that were kept by him. I know they're out there somewhere because as meticulous as he was, a jockey who is earning contracts and having to chase his money is going to keep a ledger. He's going mm-hmm. to know who owes him money for whatever race. Because that 44% was something he accounts for himself. So there is a ledger somewhere, I believe, with Murphy's notations about the horses he rode, about who owes him what, about how much he paid for his valet, to how much a train ticket costs, how much spurs or boots or a new frock coat would cost. It's out there. That's the kind of person he was. And so for me, I had to look in museums and archives and places that were at first would not seem would give me the information I was looking for, provide information. But I'll share one quick story.
Yeah.
I was watching Nova Science Now with my kids, and we're watching this one show on black holes. And something that was said kind of clicked for me. So the scientist was talking about this theoretical physics, right, that we can't see black holes because of what it does to light. It just tears it apart. It's not reflective. But we can see the effect that black holes have on the things around it. This kind of, you know. Yeah. So I thought of in terms of Murphy. Well, Murphy is kind of like that black hole. I can't necessarily see him because I don't have that cachet of evidence. But I can look at the people who he surrounded himself with. So I can go to Ed Corrigan and look at, you know, information related to Ed Corrigan. And maybe I found Murphy there or E.J. Baldwin or some of the other jockeys. And lo and behold, I'm finding this information about Ike Burns Murphy or, you know, the Kentucky jockey who is known for his honesty. And it opens up a whole new world.
And just for the record, I was wondering where you were going with that story. with Isaac Burns Murphy and black holes. I'm thinking, okay, where are we going here?
Right.
Pella McDaniels is our guest. He's the author of a new book, The Prince of Jockeys, The Life of Isaac Burns Murphy, perhaps the greatest horse jockey in history. What could African-Americans, why could they become jockeys back in those days? I mean, this business was open to them exactly because why?
Well, because of slavery, mm-hmm. because of working on the farms, working in the stables, you know, exercise boys, stable boys, they knew the horses better than the owners knew the horses. The stable boys' job was to sleep in the stalls with newly born colts to make sure that they didn't choke at night, make sure they didn't get sick. And if they got sick, they would take care of them. The exercise boys would run these horses on the track and take them through their paces. The black trainers had been former jockeys, had been stable yeah. boys themselves. And so they knew the horses.
And so they were hired to ride them.
They were hired to ride them.
You know, I wanted to give our listeners just a sense of just how skilled this man was, because he had this tendency to go for these very close finishes as a way to sort of get the crowd revved up. And these, of course, gave the owners of these horses heartache. So one day in 1886, there was a race at Saratoga, and Isaac's employer, this is a man named Lucky Baldwin, called Isaac Burns Murphy up to the grandstand and told him, "Today, no fooling around, Isaac. Just go out and run the horse." Isaac agreed, then promptly turned to all the ladies who were up there and said he would make the old man faint away, in his words. So what happened that day?
Well, you know, and so that's a great story. But I still have this idea about Isaac, because at that time, he was still very, very humble. And I'm saying this because his mother dies in 1879, and she dies when he is at Saratoga racing for J.W. Hunt Reynolds in the Fleetwood Farm out of Frankfort.
Mm-hmm.
And he had always been this very quiet boy. And this is what the trainer says, Eli Jordan. So I don't think he would have turned to the ladies uh-huh. in the stands. But that's from the newspaper clippings, because there was something being set up in the media with these types of jockeys who were bigger. You know, they were that they were bigger than their britches type
mm-hmm.
of scenario,
mm-hmm.
Or their britches were too big for them. And so, you know, what happens in this race and what happens in a number of these races is that Murphy knows the horse that he's on. He also knows the other horses that are in the race and the tendencies of other jockeys. Just think about NASCAR. And so what he understands about the horse is always important to how he finishes the race.
Mm-hmm.
He knows when a jockey gets out really fast and that horse is going to die at the turn, he's going to take his opportunity at that turn to get on the inside rail. And so when he's winning by a nose or winning by a head or sometimes winning by six lengths, it's only because he's anticipating the moves of other jockeys before they can even understand what's going on in the race.
He was that much of a scholar of what this
yes.
business was all about.
Yes. And I'll talk, you know, here's the other thing, too. When you look at the 1870 census in Lexington, on the entire sheet where you have all these freedmen listed, 1870, only Isaac and his mother, only ones able to read and write. Only those two. And I believe that she had other things in mind for him before she died, before the Freedmen's Bank collapsed. I didn't think she intended for him to be a jockey. It just happened that had she not apprenticed him off, he would have been orphaned. And an orphan child could be sent to a workhouse, could be arrested for vagrancy, and put in prison.
He learned how to read and write. Why?
That was the value of freedom. Freedom came, but you had to do something with it. And that Lexington, Kentucky community, that black community in Kentucky, in Lexington, was all over this. At the end of slavery, before the Freedmen's Bureau came in, they built their own churches. And they built their own churches, and in those churches they had their own schools. And they understood the value of education. They understood the value of community. And Isaac came from this community.
Huh. There were also these famous match races that Murphy was involved in, Pelham, including a well-known one between a horse named Salvatore and another one named Tenny. First, what's a match race, and why don't we see many of them anymore?
Well, match races are interesting because this is where the owners are matching up their breed, their particular horse, against another owner's horse. And they're putting...
It's one-on-one.
It's one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
It's one with the horse and the jockeys. Mm-hmm. You have to select the best jockey you can to ride your particular horse. You put any jockey up there without skill, that horse could run all over the track. That horse would not stay in a straight line. That horse would give up the rail, which is on the inside. So a match race also tests the pedigree. So it's one thing to test jockeys against jockeys or horses against horses, but they want to see if this horse can run consistently for two out of three. You want to win two out of three matches, right? It's a rubber match, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so this particular match race against Salvatore, who Isaac was on, and Tenny, who was written by Ed Garrison, and this was a rivalry that had been growing over the last maybe 10 years. This was not necessarily just a race about the horses. This was in New York. This was at the beginning of the banning, really, of black jockeys from certain tracks and really the pushing them off the tracks by white jockeys and white owners. And so this was kind of like Jack Johnson versus Jim Jeffries. Mm. And so with this match race, and Isaac wins by a head, if anything, maybe by a nose. There's the first photo finish ever in any sport is a part of this story, in that Murphy pulls through at the last minute and he's upright on the horse and he's looking over at Ed Garrison as he finishes.
Hmm.
And so whether or not he's trying to make a statement very clear that he's the better jockey, or he's just being Isaac Murphy looking at where the finish line is, we don't know. But that match race sets up a scenario where now it's, you know, black men versus white men, or it's black men proving that they deserve to be on this track.
You know, just hearing you talk about him, Pelham, I can't help but think that if you had the chance, you would just pay money probably to have a chance to interview Isaac Burns Murphy today.
I think it would just be a fascinating interview. Just you know, ask him about his mother and his father. Ask him about, you know, questions about, you know, his, you know, his character. I mean, here is someone who is in a game, in a sport, horse racing, that has vice, that has gambling, that, you know, jockeys at some point in the history early on were making more money from pulling horses by not winning when they could win, from gamblers who were betting on the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose the straight and narrow when he could have made, you know, who knows, in today's dollars, probably millions by pulling a horse or two.
And he still did pretty well financially anyway,
well.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so in 1883, he gets the first big contract from, you know, Kansas City's one of Kansas City's famous brothers, the Corrigan brothers, pays him $5,000 for first call during the season. Now, first call is you can ride in any race you want to unless the owner who has first call wants you to ride in the race on one of their horses. And so that was the first big contract. Well, then he gets another contract for second call from E.J. Baldwin. So now he's got $10,000 guaranteed during the season for first and second call.
Wow.
But then he also takes other smaller sums from other owners. He gives everyone an opportunity. He's, you know, he's an entrepreneur, and he's, you know, he's trying to make his way in this industry where that he understands that he has a skill set that people are seeking.
And this made him what, middle class or even upper class?
I'd say upper middle class.
I was going to say, yeah, at least.
Yeah, but he still had to pay his bills. And, you know, you got to the race on your own dime, on your own ticket, and you made these large sums of money, but you still had to pay your own valets to help you dress out for the matches, for the races. You had to pay for your own hotels. So he had to manage his money. And so this is another kind of part of him that I think is so important to understand. It wasn't that these guys just showed up, jumped on the back of a horse and rode it to a finish and were paid in, you know, dollar bills, and they went about their business. Everything was calculated. Everything was maintained in this really orderly fashion.
Because he was just that scrupulous about all that stuff.
I believe he was.
Yeah. I mean, he began riding when he was 14. Do you have a sense that he take to it right away? Was he a star right out of the gate?
No.
Or was he a late bloomer like Michael Jordan?
Well, he bloomed probably within a year. It took him about a year to bloom because he understood that this was it. You know, his mother had died. His father had died in 1865. The only real family member he had was Eli Jordan, who was a family friend who had adopted him basically as a father figure and was the trainer at Owings and Williams in Lexington. And so the first horse he got on was a horse named Volcano, which really knocked him off, bucked him off his back. And apparently he cried, but he had no choice but to get back on because there was no place to go.
Huh.
And so after that, you know, he learned how to ride the horse. He learned how to control his own emotions on the horse. I think one of the things I learned is that a horse can detect fear. They know when you're afraid, when you're on their backs. They know when you're under control, when you're in control. And so if you know the horse and you can get a feel for them, they get a feel for you, they will rise to the occasion.
So he was ultimately, you sort of touched on this a little bit, but he was ultimately a great jockey, Pelham. Why?
He was a great jockey because he understood what horse racing was all about. He understood the details of every race. He understood his horses. He understood the objective was to win. It wasn't to win by six lengths, or even if it was to win by a nose. Ultimately, it was about winning the races. He didn't have to beat his horses like some of the jockeys, like Ed Garrison, used the whip too much, they say.
Mm-hmm.
But Murphy understood. He was astute. He paid attention to things. Things that others would not. There are a couple races where he gets out very quickly And the owner said, well, why did you do that? Because I knew this horse over here was going to lag, and he's not a runner from the gate. So I had to get out sooner than later, because at some point he was going to take off. So my horse had to get out soon, and I hoped he would hang on, and he hung on to win.
Well, that's a great story. Pelham McDaniels will be speaking at 6:30 this evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. That's at 10th and Baltimore. For more information, go to kclibrary.org. Let's do this. Let's take a break. Pelham, when we come back, we'll talk about a little bit more about Ed Corrigan, a Kansas City man, and we'll talk about we'll turn to the NFL and talk about concussions, too, and what's going on with all of that. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with super sports agent Lee Steinberg or about helpful travel apps for your smartphone, you can find those at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we talk with children's author and Oscar winner William Joyce, who has a new film out. Coming up later on this hour, a symphony that plays the theme songs from video games. But this segment, we're visiting with Pelham McDaniels, the former chief, about a new book he's written, a new biography of Isaac Burns Murphy, arguably the greatest horse jockey who ever lived. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888 for your questions. Again, 816-235-2888. A Kansas City man named Edward Corrigan, you mentioned him in our first half, Pelham, played a role in Murphy's life. You say in here that Edward Corrigan had a confrontational style that made him very difficult to work for. Who was he?
Ed Corrigan was a Canadian-Irish born man who was one of six brothers, I believe, who ended up here in Kansas City. There's a Corrigan building downtown. I think people who have been downtown know the Corrigan building, but may not know the history behind it. But
yeah.
Between Ed and his brother Patrick and Bernard Corrigan, they built the streets and they built the trolleys. Ed himself went out west and helped lay the granite for the railroad, I think 100 miles between Denver and Utah.
Wow.
And that's where really he fell in love with horses too, out in that kind of, you know, on the edge of the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, you know, I write in there that in this part of Utah, he made Christians out of the Mormons because he raced them on their horses and he beat them.
Wow. And his connection to Murphy was what?
Well, for Murphy, in 1883, Corrigan, and it says in the book, and I'll read a passage here, he says, I've engaged Isaac Murphy to ride for me because I have found out by experience that it is not of very little use to have good or fair horses without having skill and honesty in the saddle.
Mm.
And so Murphy had proven himself, having not only skill and honesty, but he could win.
And so that's why Edward Corrigan wanted him.
He wanted him. He wanted a winning jockey who he can trust that was going to take a horse to the line and finish honestly.
Do you have any sense of what their relationship was like?
Well, it was tense because, again, you know, Corrigan was a hard man. He wanted results. You know, it kind of reminds you of a football coach who didn't take excuses, right?
But I bet you know about some of those guys.
I know some of those guys, right?
Yeah.
But Murphy, being himself, was going to do what he could do, and he was going to, you know, he was going to serve in not only his own interest but the best interest of the horse. And sometimes Corrigan didn't think he rode the horse properly when Murphy would argue that, no, I did. I did ride the horse properly.
You're talking here about the atmosphere in the country that allowed folks like Isaac Burns Murphy to sort of rise up in this profession. But you also have a photograph of how African-Americans were characterized in the 1880s and 1890s. It's in the photograph section of the book, and it features an African-American atop a horse. Not a very pretty picture.
It's not. And in fact, you know, Currier and Ives are, you know, they're known infamously for these caricatures of blacks in this time period. You know, the grotesque is really what it's representing. It's that kind of way of thinking about blacks that helps perpetuate these notions of their inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have someone like Murphy who carries himself with this gentlemanly decorum and has these Victorian values and virtues to depict these other ways in which to depict him as this grotesque caricature is really trying to make sure that the stereotypes and the myths about blackness are perpetuated. Even though here is this man who is, you know, on the tobacco of the day where we have baseball cards, they had tobacco cards, and Murphy was on five of them, separate ones. And so here is this really handsome man who is not just articulate, he's very thoughtful and intelligent, but to then represent these jockeys in a way that is really animalistic, if anything, it was intended to kind of unravel that significance.
Do any of those cards exist today?
I have four of the five. I'm looking for the fifth.
The originals?
Yes, those tobacco cards.
You yourself own them?
I do. I have four or five.
What are they worth?
I don't know. I was getting them for research. And so I even have some of the lithographs, some of the beautiful – Curry Knives did two things. They had multiple markets. So those that would like the caricatures, they produce those.
Yeah.
But those that really want beautiful horses with these handsome jockeys, they produce those as well. So there is a two-tier marketing thing going on here. You can have August Belmont's horse with Anthony Hamilton on it, or you can have this caricature of a black jockey who was running the wrong way on the horse backwards.
Huh. Well, there's a mystery in this book that involves a poisoning, and it changed Murphy's image in the eyes of many whites, Pelham. This happened at Monmouth Park. Am I saying that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Well, what happened? Because this is a pretty dramatic story.
Well, it's one of those turning points. The 1890s for us in the United States is a significant kind of decade. There are an average of 150 lynchings in the South during this time period, where now it seems that whites are retaliating for not just the Civil War, but for the idea that has now been that has affected African Americans, that they can become someone and something in the United States. Well, for Murphy, his success on Salvatore against Tenney and a couple of other races at Monmouth Park also created this space where individuals who had bet heavily on Tenney to win lost everything. And this created a space for the collusion between jockeys and maybe a few owners to allow for something to happen to Murphy. And so in this particular episode, Murphy at some point is poisoned. We don't know where or how it happened, because by all accounts, the depositions state that he was in the stands with his wife before the match, before the race. He had his traditional water before. He
hadn't been drinking.
Hadn't been drinking.
Yeah.
He had gone to the locker room to get prepared to get to the scales, and everything seemed fine as usual. He gets on his horse from the paddock and goes out to the track, and that's when he starts to feel something, not really understanding what, thought it was tired. As he gets to the starting line, one of the starter notices that his saddle is loose. That's the first sign that something is going on here. He gets off the horse. They tighten the saddle. He gets back on. That's when he starts feeling the effects of whatever it is. The race begins. He's listening to left and right. He finally pulls the horse, understanding what's happening here, and he falls off in a heap on the ground. And he gets help to get back on the horse, and then goes to the judge's stand, dismounts, and then goes to the locker room. Well, it's a firestorm at that point, because here is this jockey who is not only the most successful jockey, but he's a black jockey who has basically is undermining every time he wins and every time he brings himself to the track this notion of black inferiority.
Yeah.
But now here is a case to be made of his getting too big for his britches, being supposedly drunk at this race course now will have him become this, a figure that could be rejected.
A pariah.
Exactly.
For some folks. And how did the whole episode sort of wind up? Did we know? Was it ever definitively proven what had happened here?
In the Philadelphia Inquirer, there is an account that there are three people who were found to be guilty of colluding and poisoning Murphy. Now, that case, I can't find the records of the case, but I found that document, which for me was evidence that, he had not been drunk, but there was this proof that, whatever syndicate wanted these black jockeys off the racetracks, especially Murphy.
And what did Isaac Burns Murphy say about this afterwards? Do we know?
Well, he said he was poisoned. He said, I did the same thing I did every day before a race. I had the same water. I was in my stall. I went to the track. And something happened. I was poisoned. I didn't have anything to drink. I was drugged. Something else went wrong. It was not me.
How did his life wind up, Pelham? I mean, where does this man spend his final years, and what are those like for him?
Well, everything, I like to say that he was a victim in some ways of his own success. His success in the saddle and how his honesty really pulled these owners to him, and they gave him so much money because of his honesty and his ability to win, that others saw that and wanted to take it from him. They wanted to take that from him. And so eventually, the owners colluded. He had one lawsuit against a particular syndicate of owners that kept him off horses. So he got his full contract of $10,000, but they would not allow him to race. And they would not also, they would not allow him to take other mounts. And so he slowly but surely fades away. And we find him in around 1894. He still has money. When he dies, he leaves $30,000 to his wife. But he is now in plays like The Derby Winner, which actually premiered here in Kansas City, I think 1894, at the 9th Street Opera House. It's just one of those things where, you know, you have former athletes who become these vaudevillian acts, and they travel and they just are trying to draw people in based on what they used to be.
Was he a happy man when he died?
I don't think he was. I think that the episode of the poisoning and what people called him afterwards, which I won't repeat here, I think it hurt him because he had done everything right. Mm-hmm. He had been a gentleman. He had been honest. He had followed the rules. And yet even, you know, in doing so, he had to realize that America was not ready for that. They did not care that here is this honest man who, did everything correctly.
Well, before you leave us, I wanted to ask you about concussions. So much in the news these days for former NFL players. Jockeys had concussions, obviously NFL players too. I'm just wondering, you know, given all the attention on this, you're a guy who played, I think, what, 8 years in the league. Do you worry about the ramifications of the business you were once in as you move forward in a career that's so cerebral, intensive? And what about that?
Well, I really don't know what to think. I've had the fortunate opportunity to talk to a doctor at Emory named Don Stein. Mm-hmm. And Don Stein does brain trauma research. And his work is in the emergency room mostly. And, you know, we've talked and I've asked him, what do you think about this? I've had some concerns, but I kind of don't think about it right now because I'm fine. But he said to me, he says, well, Pelham, not everyone will have the same effect. I mean, who knows what your brain has done differently? Who knows if reading and spending time intellectually thinking about questions and seeking the answer to those questions have done something? I don't know. I know that when we treat brain injuries, there's a way in which we can do that would keep that injury from having a long-term effect. That's what he does. As it relates to the concussions in the NFL, not to be, man with the party line, but there are certain aspects of playing sports that sometimes we have to deal with. I know boxers know that punch drunk is what happens if you get hit in the head too much. So you better be pretty good, knock a guy out in the first two rounds.
So are you saying that do you question former NFL players who have filed these lawsuits?
I don't. No, it's to each its own. I think, but for me, if there is something greater happening, I don't know about it right now, and I'm trying to, kind of wait it out before I make my decision on what side of the argument that I'm on. Mm-hmm. Because right now, it's very hard for me to see not the validity of the argument or the lawsuits
from the players.
From the player's standpoint, I understand that there are certain things that have been said about the doctors not telling the truth, the trainers not telling the truth about the consequences of playing football long term, and that concussions can have long term effects. But I'm not necessarily sold on all of it yet. I'm listening. I'm waiting.
Did you suffer concussions when you played?
I think I had two.
Mm-hmm. In all those years?
Yeah, I think I had two.
They occurred when? Do you recall what happened?
On a kickoff return and one.
That'll do it.
Yeah, kickoff return will do it. And then another making a tackle on one of the icy fields. I think it was in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. You just hit your head hard?
Just hit my head.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to a couple phone calls here. Let's go to Florence from Kansas City, Missouri. Florence, you're on Up to Date with Pelham McDaniels. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. McDaniels, I'm listening. I'm an Afro-American, and I just want to thank you for your research and bringing this truth. I never knew about Isaac Murphy. Thank you for the enlightenment. We appreciate others like you who bring us truth and enlightenment. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a nice phone call.
That was a very nice phone call.
Yeah. Now, I've got to ask, how much ribbing do you get from your old teammates about, the defensive end who went on to get a PhD?
I don't hear from a lot of guys, It's funny. But
maybe they're intimidated by you now.
I don't know. Yeah. I get more correspondence really from the Players Association and the NFL alumni because they're posting these stories about where they're now. And so we've had I've had a lot of attention from my teaching. Just last month, April, we put together an exhibition, three student athletes and I and another administrator, around Hank Aaron's, breaking of Babe Ruth's record, the anniversary of
it. Sure.
And that's been huge. And so, my teaching for me is really important. But the research, I don't hear from too many people.
I also wanted to ask you, when you played here, there were a whole lot of veteran players with the Chiefs in those days. I'm thinking about guys like Joe Montana and Marcus Allen and Derek Thomas. What kind of influence did guys like that have on a team in general?
Right. There was one thing, and this is something I carry with me about work ethic.
Yeah.
Marcus used to, in practice, 9-on-7, he would always, 9-on-7 just the run. We're fitting for, gaps for run responsibilities, defense and offensively. And Marcus would run the ball, and he would break the line of scrimmage, and he would make a move on, an invisible defender in the middle of the field, and he would run all the way to the end zone. And then he would jog back. And one day, Greg Hill said to him, he says, "Hey, old man, why are you running all the way down the field?" And it's like, wow, hey, old man, why are you running all the way down the field? And Marty, Marcus, you don't have to run, all the way down the field. Marcus' response was, well, how will I know what to do in the open field if I don't practice it? How will I know how to, make that move if I don't practice that in these moments right now? And I just remember that because, it's being prepared for any and everything that allows for you to be successful and make it look effortless. And I think that's, if anything, I appreciate that the most.
What a thrill to have been able to play with guys
like that.
That was great.
And, of course, Joe is something unique. And both Joe and Joe, because, when I was a kid growing up in the Bay Area, Joe was on the 49ers team and Marcus was of course, in Oakland. So, these are two guys who I played with on the same team who I looked up to as a kid growing up in San Jose.
What's your favorite Joe Montana story from his years with the Chiefs?
It happens after. We're in a restaurant. A friend of mine flew from Tokyo, Musashi University, came here to do some work at the Major League Baseball Museum. And Kohai Kawashima. And Kohai and I are sitting in Jack Stacks on the plaza. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And we're sitting down having dinner. And Joe walks in. Hey, Joe Montana walks in. And I said, hey, Joe, how are you doing? He said, hey, Woody, how's it going? I'm like, oh, just back in town trying to, help a friend here who's doing research. And Kohai looks and his mouth is wide open and he says, Joe Montana-san. I was like, yeah. He goes, you want to meet him? And Joe's like, hey, how's it going? He's like, oh, my gosh. This is Joe Montana. And, it's just, I think it was fun because here I am, one of thousands of players probably the guys played with or, had contact with, and he remembered me, So that was probably the coolest thing.
Pelham McDaniel speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch 10th and Baltimore downtown. More information, kclibrary.com. Pelham's new book, The Prince of Jockeys, A Life of Isaac Burns Murphy. Always good to have you here at Pelham. Thanks for taking some time.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
Really enjoyed it.